Alan, I think both of us would agree that one of the major problems in the whole medical care area, connected, closely connected with the present crisis, is the practice we've gotten into of having the employer, in the main, be responsible for people's health care. Now, I know that that wasn't always the case. When I was growing up in the 1920s and 30s, that was not the practice, or at least it was very rarely the practice. How did we ever get into that silly business? No, I say silly, because I see no more reason why employers should provide in-kind health care than why they should provide food or clothing or housing. And when we had company towns, people objected to that. Why don't they object now? What is it? How did we get into this practice?
Well,
when did it start?
Well, we stumbled into it.
How?
Back in the 30s, there was virtually no employer-provided health insurance. Right. Health insurance was growing up under the sponsorship of the Blue Cross and Blue Shields, which were hospital and doctor-created associations to assure that there was a financing vehicle to get their bills paid for them. The way employers got into it really was during World War II, that the government was spending some 45% of the gross national product and created a tremendous excess demand for labor and was trying to hold down wages, and so there were...
When you say trying to hold down wages, stop. You mean the government had wage and price control.
Yes,
they
right.
They set a limit on the wages that employers
exactly.
could pay.
And so in the face of excess demand, pushing against these wage and price controls, and another important factor that came into this was the growth of organized labor. Recall that back in the 30s with the Wagner Act and all that, organized labor became a much larger and more important force in our economy. So those forces came together in World War II with unions demanding wage increases.
But whether unions had been demanding wage increases or not in a booming economy,
sure.
the employers would have tried to find some way to attract workers.
Right. And so the government, not wanting to yield on the wage and price controls, said you may give health insurance as a fringe benefit.
Well, was it the government's idea that health insurance should be the fringe benefit? It must have been that the employers thought of the idea of health insurance as a fringe benefit, as something they could use.
Well, I think coming from the side of the unions, that health benefits have always been a wonderful source of bargaining prizes. You know, stick with me, boys. Last year I got you free doctor visits. This year I'll get you hearing aids and crutches, and next year I'll get you wheelchairs. And so I think that, you know, as a source of wonderful sounding bargaining prizes, it's always been great for organized labor. But basically, as I understand it, that was it, that the government said, you can't increase the wages, but we will accede to your demands to have employers provide health insurance.
That will not be regarded as a violation of wage control.
Right.
But should it not have been taxed?
Well, again, the way so many things happen in the Internal Revenue Code, you know, it wasn't a policy, it just happened, and that is, employers started paying for health insurance, and since the Internal Revenue Code was silent on the subject, they didn't pay tax on it. It was untaxed. Then,
and partly, if I have to add my own personal note here, I was involved in 1941 and 42 in developing withholding at source, which involved W-1s, the ubiquitous form. My wife has never forgiven me for my involvement, but it involves you that every employer has to file a form.
Right.
And undoubtedly, when we drew up those forms, we never took into account at all that there was going to be health insurance.
Right.
So it called for cash wage payment.
Right. And so cash wages were taxed, but not health insurance. It just, the law was silent, so they didn't pay taxes on it. Then, when the issue came up, for example, in the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, by then...
54?
Yeah.
You mean it didn't come up till then?
As I recall, there was a certain amount of questioning of it, but it was sustained but not codified.
So that was 9 years it lasted.
And by then, the practice of free, tax-free employer-provided health insurance was so widespread, so many millions of people were getting so much money from it, that politically it would have been impossible to tax it. So it just, you know, it was a thin end of the wedge, if you like, it just grew, And there it
was.
Well,
didn't the IRS make some efforts to tax it at that
time? I think so.
And then did Congress explicitly pass a law exempting it?
In the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, in sections 105 and 106, Congress explicitly excluded from taxable incomes employer contributions, first to health insurance and then to just health benefits.
It's always fascinated me, not about this issue alone, but about so many cases, how something gets started for one reason and mm-hmm. ultimately develops in something altogether different.
Right.
And yet once it develops, you can't get rid of it.
That's right.
It's what my wife and I called in the title of one of our books, The Tyranny of the Status Quo.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to make a mistake than it is to correct a mistake.
Yeah.
That's true for individuals too. It's very easy to bang your car up, but it's not so easy to fix it after you have.
Yeah.
So that's how it got to be the practice of employers.
And then that became, for a time, the second largest by dollar volume and by number of people affected, the largest federal health insurance program, that is the tax subsidies to employer-provided health insurance.
Sure.
And nobody ever had that in mind at all when they passed that legislation.
Sure.
It just happened. It grew.
Now, on the other hand, as I understand it, under present law, if I or any other individual, self-employed or independent, not employed, buys insurance or pays for his health care, that only gets deductible if his total costs exceed a specified fraction of his total income. That is, on the income tax, I think, what is it now, 5%?
Is it 5 or 7? I'm not sure.
I think it's 5%. It used
5%,
to be 3%,
yeah.
Then it was raised to 5%.
Yeah.
It may have been raised again for all I know. So that there's an enormous incentive for an individual who is employed to have the employer continue to do it.
That's right. And if you think back to pre-1986, when many, many people were in the 50% marginal tax bracket, counting the federal, state, the state income taxes are in this, and the payroll taxes also. I remember about 1978 or 9, a young woman graduating from Stanford was asking me for job advice, and I was asking her about the pay and the different options, and that night I thought, gee, I wonder, for this young lady stepping off of the farm and into the job market, what's going to be her marginal tax bracket? And to my amazement, I computed it, and it was over 50% when you count the payroll taxes and the state income tax and the federal, and you combine them. And so it makes an enormous difference to have your employer pay for it.
Sure. What it means is that if you pay for it, for every dollar you pay for it, your employer can afford to pay, that is, instead of giving you a dollar in wages, well, I should put it differently. If he gives you a dollar in wages, you have left maybe 50 cents,
right,
because after you've paid your taxes. If he gives you a dollar in medical care, you get a dollar's.
Right.
I won't say you get a dollar's worth of medical care.
No.
But you get a dollar spent on medical care.
Right. It's a very important distinction.
A very, very, important, very important distinction.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that's surely one of the major reasons why costs have gone up as much as they have.
I think so.
Now, right. The question then comes down, what can we do about it? My own utopian preference, if I had my way, I would like to return to what I think is the right system, eliminate the tax exemption of employer-provided medical care. If you eliminated the tax exemption to the recipient of employer-provided medical care, you would establish a very strong incentive for workers and employers to agree on a different method of wage payment. In that case, the worker would have an incentive to have the employer pay him the equivalent of what the employer is now spending on medical care, have the employer pay it to him in cash, and let him manage his own medical care, because he could then decide rationally how much he wanted to buy and what it was worth. But you will tell me, and you will be correct, that's a dream in the sky, pie in the sky, that given the present political situation, there's not a chance of a snowball in hell that you can get that done. So I wonder whether you don't agree that a second best solution, not the best solution, but a second best solution would be to establish medical IRAs. That is to say, have a situation under which John Jonesy employee, in return for the employer not providing medical care directly, the employer deposits in a special medical IRA account for John Jonesy employee, let's say 10% of his salary, whatever may be the average cost that he's now incurring for medical care. And that is deposited there free of tax and free to accumulate without paying tax on interested earnings or anything. And then that ends the employer responsibility for medical care. He's discharged it by paying this fee. And then the employee can use that sum as he wants. If he wants to join an HMO, he can. If he wants to buy insurance, he can. If he wants to operate on a direct pay, he goes to the physician and pays him his fee, he can. It would seem to me that that ought to be politically feasible and much more sensible than our present system.
Well, one of the things I've learned in the past decade or two working on this problem is that incrementalism is one of the first laws of our democracy, and that whatever idea you bring to the policy process, they put it through the blender and cut it up into very fine pieces. And so that I think that that would be seen as a very radical change.
But isn't
change.
It's fairly incremental.
Well,
we have other kind of, we have an IRA. Yeah. It's building on a standard pattern. And put it a different way. Suppose that alternative were presented to workers. It wouldn't be compulsory.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose that alternative were presented to workers. My guess is that 90% of them would vote to do it.
Well, let me come back to the employment basis of health insurance. While I agree that that's got a lot wrong with it, and if we were starting afresh now, that's not the way we would go. We wouldn't want people to lose their health insurance when they lose their job, arguably when they need it the most.
You see, you speak always, stop me.
Yeah.
I got to stop you, because everybody in this business speaks as if health insurance is the way health should be provided, health care.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's absurd. I think what people need is a major medical insurance thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that the better way for ordinary health care is for people to buy health care the way they buy food and clothing and housing, by going to the physician and making an agreement with him and paying him his fee directly between patient
okay,
and physician.
Okay, but here, the problem with that, Milton, is that today healthcare expenses are highly concentrated. In any given year, something like 70% of the dollars will be accounted for by 10% of the patients or less.
But that would be taken care of by having
a major
medical.
Okay, so the important, if you're saying it would be a good idea to structure it so that people were much more cost conscious, acted like they're using their own money for those things that people could reasonably budget for. Sure, that makes a lot of sense. But there would remain, what do you do about the 70% of the dollars that are spent on the 10% of the people who have the highest costs? And we need to bring some kind of incentive.
If you have major medical insurance,
yeah,
that 70% would come out of the major medical insurance.
But now we have to talk about how do we structure that major medical insurance in such a way that once people are caught up in that, there is still some incentive for somebody to treat the patient in the most economical
way. By having
way.
Those be private insurance corporations who have every incentive to do that.
Okay.
And no different from the fire insurance, life insurance, and other things.
Yeah.
So let's go back.
So we'd want a regime in which health insurers were able to contract selectively with doctors and the hospitals that they thought were efficient and effective.
Not necessarily. I don't know. Look, I think it's a great mistake to try to figure out what devices the market will produce. We're not smart enough to do that. If we were, we'd be central planners. You want to set up a system under which the right people have the right incentives.
Okay. But let me just say, in this particular thing about insurers contracting selectively, is that the reason the market didn't produce that until about 10 years ago is because the doctors and the hospitals didn't want that. They wanted a kind of insurance where once you were insured, you were free to go to absolutely anyone.
Oh, I understand.
And it was really a political battle to overturn the law against that and to allow people to make choices. And when people wanted to make choices, they started choosing HMOs and preferred provider insurance, that is, arrangements where the insurance premium you paid was linked to the doctors you choose. So if you chose economical doctors, that held down your premium.
But let's keep these things separate.
Okay.
For the great bulk of people, year after year, the cost that they would bear would be of the same order of magnitude as the kind of cost they bear now to buy beer and cigarettes for those who smoke or to or to engage in recreation, much less than they spend on food. Mm-hmm. Because for decades, total medical care costs were about 4% of income. 4 to 5% of income. Yeah. And if we separate out these major medical costs, and they too, the total of those would only need to be a few percent of income. Mm-hmm. What's happened now is that we have an enormously inefficient system with tremendous waste, with the most extraordinary administrative complexity you can imagine. So let's go back. For most people, they ought to engage, they will get their ordinary health care. If you actually look at the facts, they're striking. The difference in the premium you pay for an insurance policy which has a large deductible and an insurance policy which has a small deductible is extremely high. If you buy a policy with a deductible of $3,000 versus a deductible of $100, the difference in premium is almost $3,000.
Sure. Of course, there's a very important reason for that, which is, given a choice, the people who do not expect to go to the doctor this year choose the high deductible and the low premium because they expect to pay just the premium, whereas the people who are sick and expecting to go to the doctor soon, choose the low deductible.
I don't doubt that happens.
Right. But that's rational behavior.
Yes, but it's also rational behavior that if I have a low deductible, I will be much less careful.
Sure. Yeah.
About how much I spend on medical care than if I have a high deductible.
Okay.
But let me go back to the main point. You were starting to say that given that we have a system in which the employers do it, and I take it also you're taking another conclusion, and that is ruling out the possibility of personal medical IRAs.
Well, I wouldn't rule that out. I'm all in favor of incentives for saving and for responsible behavior and economy, but I want to keep coming back to keep reminding you that most of the costs and the most inflationary element of the costs are in that 70% that goes with the 10% of the people who are really sick.
I don't agree with you that 70% would not be affected, that the 70% itself would not be very strongly affected.
Okay, let me come back to another aspect of this, which is this a market that can be organized effectively at the level of the individual consumer and on the one hand and the insurance company on the other hand? And I think that for several reasons, we need to have some collective functions that are today performed by large employers, which needs to be performed by some other agency. Let me just explain here. First, the administrative costs in individual health insurance, because of the marketing, the contracting, everything else, are very high, like 40% of premium.
Not for major, secondly, for high deductible insurance. I beg your pardon. You keep insisting. You keep adopting the common practice now that unless a person has insurance, he can't get medical care. Now that's nonsense. It depends on the kind of insurance. Most of the people who are uninsured, you know, there's all this talk about 35 million people. Most of them are healthy young people who have decided it isn't worth the cost of getting insured. Now,
because they know somebody will take care of them if they're seriously ill.
If they're serious. Now, I believe that there is a case for requiring everybody to have a major medical insurance major. I believe there is a case, just as there's a case for requiring everybody who drives an automobile to have a liability policy.
Right.
And so I'm not quarreling with that.
Yeah.
And I in my favorite arrangement, it would be required that everybody has a major medical insurance program, but a very, very high deductible, not $3,000, but something like $10,000 or $20,000, or 10% of income, 20% of income, whichever is lower.
Yeah.
So in some cases, it would be $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's, for a moment, argue on my grounds rather than yours. Let's just assume that that you could have a major medical program for everybody had a major medical of that kind.
Yeah.
Now do your arguments have as much cogency?
Well, I think so, because
Why?
Well, I'd be worried about two things. One is, okay, we're in a world, we're in a world now where everybody just has major medical insurance. I'm still thinking about the need for some collective action. First of all, insurers are becoming increasingly skilled at charging high premiums to the people who have high medical costs and low premiums to the people who have low costs.
That's right. They should. They should. And
well, I think
you're not opposed to risk premiums for automobiles. And indeed, we've discovered that we had a national disaster because we don't have risk premiums for deposit insurance.
Well,
surely risk premiums are, there's nothing wrong with risk premiums.
I think in the case of health care, that it comes up against a social value that sick people ought to be cared for and that risks ought to be spread.
But if you have the, well, hold on about risks being spread.
Okay.
We have a redistributive income tax system already.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought it amazing that we should have, first of all, we have a redistributive income tax system so that tax rates go up as incomes go up. And then for each individual separate program, we also have a redistributive thing. Why should we have housing distributed on a progressive income tax scale?
Okay.
Why should we have medical? I don't believe that the
risks
should of people first of all, many illnesses are self-imposed. People who smoke, people who engage in unhealthy habits, and I do not see any case for risk sharing in those cases, except through purchase of insurance, any more than I do in the case of automobiles.
Well,
should uninsured automobile, and let's take our automobile owners, who are uninsured, who don't insure, should the costs they impose on themselves be risk shared across the public at large?
No, but I think healthcare is different.
Why?
First, okay, it's
in
fair
fact,
enough.
More people more people mess up their health in automobile accidents than almost any other way.
All right, it is fair enough to say that a lot of ill health comes from irresponsible behavior and self-inflicted ill health, smoking, lack of exercise, and so forth.
Let alone unsafe sex practices.
Right, fair enough. On the other hand, it's also true that a lot of ill health comes from involuntary misfortune.
Absolutely.
And I think here we're up against a question of social value. I believe that to the extent that it's involuntary misfortune, there needs to be some way of spreading that risk when the costs get large. That is that people
But
need
we've already
to be
done that with having assumed major medical insurance.
No, because the major medical insurance you're talking about, if it just works at the individual level, the insurers will skillfully underwrite each person, and they'll look at person A and say, you've had a history of cancer, and so next year we're going to quadruple the premium in your policy. This happens to individuals in small employment groups all the time. In effect, we're going to readjust the premium each year to your expected medical costs in the coming year, so
well,
that the risk spreading part of insurance
you,
breaks
give
down.
You, I want to separate issues.
Okay.
So let me go to a more extreme case, which I don't like, but which would be far better than what we have now. You have universal major medical with the deductibles I've stated very high, paid for by the federal government.
Well, what bothers me about that is again, I keep coming back to seeing a regime where the 70% of the dollars are going to be in a cost uncontained mode because moral hazard will take over. The patient says, I don't care what it costs because I'm insured, and the doctor says, I don't care what it costs because you're insured, and there's no mechanism to force.
Where does those 70% come from? They come from cost per bed in hospitals
right.
going up 26-fold. Mm-hmm. And that happens because you have employer-based thing, because you have government assuming responsibility, not simply to pay the insurance premium. See, I would have the medical, major medicals provided by private people, by private insurance companies.
Yeah, not by the government. The government, sure, right.
And you have government providing Medicare and Medicaid now, mm-hmm. and those are enormously expensive, much more expensive than they need to be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm very dubious of your 70% figure based on a present crazy system.
Well, that is the figure. It's pretty well documented. The Rand Corporation did a health insurance experiment in which they found, for example, that any given year, the 1% of patients who had the highest costs accounted for 28% of the costs.
But take automobile insurance.
Yeah. But this is very different. Yeah, but this is very different from automobile insurance.
Why?
Well, for one thing, because when people are seriously ill, let's say they have clogged coronary arteries, there is just no end to what can be done on their behalf, and the costs can become enormous. So with soft organ
and
transplants
course,
and all these things
major,
now,
major medical
we're talking
insurance.
About many therapies
of
that
cost
$100,000, $200,000, $300,000.
But even on major medical insurance, you ought to have a co-insurance payment, just as you do
right.
on almost anything.
The problem with that is that of just relying on the co-insurance is that people demand financial protection, so they'll want to have a stop loss, and they'll say, after I've paid $5,000 out of pocket or something like that, let's say 20% of income, then I want a stop loss and I want the insurance to pay all the rest. And I would say the problem is most of the dollars are beyond the stop loss and in the free care zone. And so I think we need to create an insurance mechanism where doctors who practice economically can affiliate with an insurance scheme that can offer people a low premium. And that is a key mechanism.
But
in
you
the whole
don't
thing.
Have to compel that.
No, I think that a market system would produce that.
I'm not objecting to the emergence of HMOs
mm-hmm.
or hospital insurance. On the contrary.
Yeah.
In fact, back in 1962, when I published Capitalism and Freedom, I made a case that the organized medicine was preventing the efficient organization
right.
of hospitals.
In fact,
and I think organized medicine was preventing it.
In fact, to this day, was that 62? Now, 30 years later, I'm very happy to be able to tell you my students read that in my course, and we talk about that. And I think it was marvelously prescient. You talked about it made so much sense. It would be like a department store because, of course, the individual consumer isn't going to know who's the best ologist that he might need in the middle of the night. So he needs some reputable organization, somebody he can trust that he can choose ahead of time. And so you'd use the analogy of a department store mm-hmm. with their buyers and all that. It makes a lot of sense. You need today we would call that a multi-specialty group practice.
But why didn't it develop? It didn't develop at that time. because of the opposition of the medical monopoly.
Right, exactly.
And I think the right answer would have been to eliminate the medical monopoly.
Right. We're slowly chipping away at that.
You know, I'll tell you something. In my opinion, there's only room for one monopolist at a time. We are chipping away at the medical monopoly by replacing it by a government monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And as between the two monopolies, I'm very uncertain which is worse.
Yeah, right.
Because at the moment, because of this chipping away, mm-hmm. we seem headed inevitably toward complete socialized medicine. And I think that would be such a disaster for a country like the United States.
Sure it would.
That we ought not to rule out the possibility of getting substantial changes like medical IRAs. I understand the difficulty that you tend to get very incremental changes in any system, and that is an incremental change, but a big increment. But let's suppose for a moment that we had the medical IRAs. Let's suppose included in that was a major medical insurance program. Now, what collective measurement methods other than the competition of insurance companies for patients and of physicians for service mm-hmm. would be necessary to make that an efficient operating system?
Well, I can think of several. One is to do with the definition of the contract. Health insurance contracts are extremely complex. I think many people who write about health policy fail to understand that. They don't know what's in their own policy, for example.
You know, nobody ever reads his automobile policy either.
Right. And health insurance policies are much, much more complex. And I think that...
Have you recently read your automobile insurance policy through?
No.
Well, then be careful.
No. Okay. You mean that they're pretty bad, too. All right. And in fact, I think that even a very intelligent individual is not going to be in a good position to judge, is this a good policy or not. There are problems of air pockets. I chair the Health Benefits Advisory Council for the state employees, and we have 27 different competing health plans. And recently we have decided that we will standardize on one single contract. And one of the main reasons for that is so that we could understand the contract. And in the process of standardization, we found things like Plan A covers transplants, including the cost of harvesting and transporting the organ. Plan B in the bold print says we cover transplants too, but in the fine print it says, but we don't cover the cost of harvesting and transplanting the organ. So somebody in the middle of the night suddenly, you know, never thought about that, suddenly finds, you know, my coverage failed me when I needed it. So I think we need some, now I'm not saying the government, I'm looking for some other way of doing this, but we need some collective agency that will...
You mean like the Consumers Union?
Or spread risk. So, well, what's the proposal I've been making this year I call a health insurance purchasing cooperative. Imagine that all the small employers and self-employed and maybe even the large employers in a given area like San Mateo County got together and said, we will create locally here, a collective purchasing agency. We will, with a board of directors that responds to the members, we will put on our expertise to figure out what is a good contract, what's economical but protects people and so forth. And then we'll put that out to bid, and different health plans will offer their system and style of care to meet that contract, and we'll offer all the people a choice, and people will make a cost-conscious choice. Everybody has to pay more.
If that is a desirable thing,
yeah.
Why won't it emerge in a market system? Why do you have to have...
good question. Very good question, for which I have a lot of respect.
And hold on.
Yeah.
In a market system in which the individual health recipients are the buyers of health of health services and not the employers.
It's the risk spreading aspect. That is, market forces are unfortunately centrifugal with respect to risk sharing. That is, the healthy young groups, or the people who are healthy this year, say we don't want to be pooled with this other group that is having higher costs.
Well, fine. Why should they be?
Well,
why should they be?
Okay.
Why should they be compulsorily pooled?
Because what
if
happens
if they choose not to be?
Yeah. Well, the problem is, 2 or 3 years later, this group of people, all of whom were healthy, show up with
But you're underestimating the foresight of people. People don't just look at 1 year. People do all sorts of things they provide for contingencies. Now everybody knows that if he signs up for this, he's guaranteed renewal for X years or whatever it may be, and that if he isn't guaranteed, that another plan which offers cheap doesn't guarantee renewal.
Well, right now, actually, most people are not guaranteed renewal, and that is one of the big...
Of course not, because there's Uncle Sam standing there.
Well, in fact, that's one of the proposed legislative reforms, is to require guaranteed renewal. But guaranteed renewal by itself, I'm afraid, wouldn't be good enough to solve the problem, because if, you know, they'll say, sure, we'll renew your policy, but we're going to increase the price by a factor of 10.
You see, the thing that always amazes me about the kind of discussion you're engaging in, we have mountains of experience that writing a law, that good people writing a good law, does not mean that a good law will end up, that it will end up as a good law?
No, I'm not advocating that particular law.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just saying that is, I'm offering as evidence that there is guaranteed renewal today, that one of the big reform proposals is to require guaranteed
renewal.
But
all you want is for people to have the options. You want the market to provide them a maximum of options. And I'm saying if the consideration you're mentioning is an important one, I'm not saying it isn't, well, then I believe it will be in the self-interest of insurance companies or other groups to offer those options.
No, I think what's happening is more and more insurers are doing several things. One is they differentiate the product. They produce a great variety of different health insurance contracts in order to differentiate the product, that is to make it hard for people to make price comparisons, to segment markets. There's one policy for the people who want mental health, another policy for the people who want eyeglasses and so forth, to obviate price competition for a package of comprehensive services. And so they segment markets, they differentiate products, and they select risks.
Am I wrong that many states have regulations about the minimum provisions that have to be included in health insurance?
Yes, most states have laws about that. Unfortunately, those laws have become perverted, as you would expect.
Exactly,
that
the
provider interests, you know, the people who do creative dance therapy want to require that creative dance therapy. There's a state, I understand, in which pastoral counseling has to be included in the insured benefit package. And that's why
don't you think it'd be better off if you didn't have any of those laws?
Those laws, yes, right.
Stop you for a moment. We agree we'd be better off those laws.
Mm-hmm.
You really think if you and I could sit down and write some laws that we'd have a ghost of a chance of having them adopted in a way in which they wouldn't be corrupted the same way?
No. Well, I don't know. No, I've developed some market reform proposals that are being worked out in a legislative form now, and while I'm not too comfortable with some of the changes that get made in the legislative slaughterhouse, I have some hope that maybe something better than what we have now will follow. Although I grant you your point, that is, when the legislators, sometimes I feel like I sent you back there in Washington to design for a beautiful airplane. First thing that happened when it got there is somebody said, well, we like your design, but we want to take off the left wing.
Right, exactly.
Right. And I said, wait, it won't fly.
And after it gets through the law, it gets in the hands of the administrators.
But let me come back to, I just want to recognize about the employment basis of health insurance. While I agree that it's got a lot wrong with it, it does some things that are valuable that I would like to see vested in some institutions. Let's say at Stanford with our 10,000 employees, okay, we have a benefits office and a benefits committee. We study different contracts and decide what is a sensible contract, that'll protect people, because most people don't have time to become experts on it, so we'll share our expertise with our colleagues. We pre-select several competing options. We spread risks over our group, that is, each health plan charges the same premium to every member of the group, and in effect we make them compete on price. That is, we don't let them differentiate the product by, you know, this one has eyeglasses but no hearing aids, this one has hearing aids but no glasses and so forth. We say we want a standard product, and because we want to make you compete on price, because we think all this stuff costs too much, and we want to put maximum pressure on you to get your price down.
Well, let's see.
So,
suppose Stanford was not responsible for paying for health care.
Right.
Almost every one of those things you're talking about, it would be possible to do independently.
By some other institution?
No. Stanford could do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason.
Oh.
Stanford has other things that its faculty is organized to do.
Yeah.
I know that there are some universities which provide advice about where you should send your children to school.
Well, what I'm worried about is I think this goes beyond just information and advice. I think it
sure does.
You know,
that's what I don't like.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, I'm looking for ways of getting maximum incentives for efficiency and economy, but trying to recognize that there is a, you know, a kind of collective desire for some risk spreading.
But I beg your pardon, I believe that I want to emphasize personal responsibility, individual responsibility for oneself and for one's family.
Well, my model has that.
With as much risk sharing as individuals separately believe they should buy.
Well, would you deal with the problem through long-term contracts then? I mean, if I now...
If long-term contracts are what people want to buy, fine. I don't want to legislate it.
Yeah. Let me just say, this is a market in which it's very difficult to create long-term contracts because medical technology changes. In fact, one of our big problems is it's been very difficult to create enforceable contracts at all. One of the big problems that's going on these days is...
Well, of course, the litigation problem is a separate problem.
Yeah.
I always think of the case of malpractice insurance, which has become something of a scam.
Yeah.
And what's really involved in malpractice insurance is that the physician or the hospital is selling the patient two goods. He's selling the patient medical care, and he's selling the patient a lottery ticket. People always complain about how much malpractice insurance adds to the cost of doing medicine. Insofar as it leads to preventive tests and so on, it does. But otherwise, it's just the administrative costs. The rest, it's a lottery. Some people get it. Now, it's always seemed to me that a physician ought to be able to say to his patient, look, I have two fees. I'm going to separate these two elements.
Right.
If you will sign a statement releasing me from responsibility, your fee will be X. If you want to keep the possibility, if you want to buy the lottery ticket, in other words, your fee will be higher.
You'll share in my malpractice insurance premium.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, the only problem with that is that no courts today would enforce it.
Well, exactly.
50 years ago, they would have enforced it.
Right.
There's been the change in the litigation explosion and the change in the legal treatment of liability insurance, which I think has been a very bad thing. Which makes such an agreement unenforceable in the courts.
Well,
and I wonder how many of these contracts that you're talking about are unenforceable for that reason, and how many for perfectly valid reasons?
Well, let's see. You got me. I'd have to think about that.
Yeah, but that's really a problem.
Yeah.
Because, of course, these problems all get intertwined.
Right.
And what are they? What is it that they're intertwined into? Because that sets a background. We've been having a movement away from
individual responsibility
to social responsibility.
Sure. Yeah.
That movement reached its peak in countries like Russia and China. We're heading in that direction. We're only partway there. We're only halfway there. But I shudder when I think of the ultimate consequences of continuing to move in that direction. You can't separate out medicine from the whole society.
Sure. But I don't think we're disagreeing on that. I mean, the kind of reforms I'm proposing and designing are trying to roll back in the direction of increased, you know, I talk about the need for informed, responsible choice, a price-conscious choice. Everybody has to bear the economic consequences of their choices and be rewarded for making the most economical. But it's in the context of a model that I think might actually be politically feasible.
Well, I'm just trying to urge you to be a little more radical.
Be more radical, right.
To extend your vision of what's politically feasible, because I'm not thinking of this solely in terms of medicine. I believe there is a movement building in this country which is reacting strongly against the trend we're developing. I think the Perot phenomenon was a manifestation of that phenomenon. Perot himself would have gone in the opposite direction. He was a big government man. He wasn't a personal responsibility man, despite all his rhetoric. But the attempt, the desire by people all over to find some movement in that direction. So I think that there is, I don't think we're going to continue heading in this direction. And I think in area after area, we ought to try to think somewhat more radically in the direction of how we can provide mechanisms or ways of movement or ways of thinking about things, which will help us to move farther back away from the social responsibility to personal responsibility?
I'm thinking that given strongly held social values that people who are seriously ill ought to be cared for, that we can move in the direction of individual responsibility while still having some spreading of risk.
But let me note that socially held position is very old. Mm-hmm. You go back before there was Medicare, before there was mm-hmm. Blue Cross Blue Shield. Seriously ill people in general were taken care of. Mm-hmm. Hospitals, look.
Without being driven into bankruptcy.
Hold on for a moment. In the 1930s or 20s, mm-hmm. when my wife and I were growing up and we went to hospitals, we never were asked, do you have an insurance company? Mm-hmm. We never were asked.
Yeah.
We were taken, in an emergency, you were taken into the hospital and treated. And then later they would come around and try to give you a bill and try to find out how it was going to be paid. But today, you go into a hospital, you can't get treatment until you've delivered them three insurance cards mm-hmm. or some assurance of financial responsibility.
Of course.
So that social feeling of responsibility for somebody who's seriously ill has eroded. It's mm-hmm. not gotten stronger. Mm-hmm. It was stronger before we had this system.
Yeah. Of course, the costs are, these things all interrelate to each other. They're dependent variables, but the costs are enormously higher now, as you've noted. And medical technology can do all these very costly, wonderful things, which then...
But many of those costs are higher not because of the improvements in medical technology, not because of the improvements in medical...
Sure.
After all, many of the improvements in medicine have made costs cheaper, not more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By providing means of prevention,
mm-hmm.
by advanced inoculation, by shortening the stays in hospitals.
Mm-hmm. But let's say, though, a bypass graft operation efficiently provided will consume the annual income of the average American.
Let's take a bypass operation because I've had two of them. And I can speak with some personal authority.
You read the bill.
Yes, right. And my first one was nothing like so expensive as my second.
Mm-hmm.
And my second was nothing like so expensive as I hear people now talking about.
Right.
And that's not because there have been any improvements whatsoever
mm-hmm.
in the techniques or in the success rate. It's entirely because of an addition of administrative costs, of new regulations,
but still, the fact would remain, I think, that a bypass graft efficiently
provided... My initial bypass operation,
I
had it in 1972, if I recall, the costs were of the neighborhood of $3,000. That was not something which was beyond the reach.
Wow.
Which exceeded the annual income.
You mean that's the hospital and the doctor?
I had it at Mayo Clinics.
For $3,000?
Mayo Clinic. I think it was... You know, I won't guarantee it wasn't four.
Okay.
But mm-hmm. it certainly wasn't 10.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1972.
Okay.
And that was 20 years ago.
And what do we have in the price level? Fourfold?
From 1972 to 92?
Yeah.
Probably at most a doubling or tripling.
because...
Make that 6,000 today.
No, I think it would be more, but...
It would be.
But the Mayo Clinic is an efficient provider.
The second one I had is the Stanford Hospital, which is also supposed to be an efficient provider.
No. I wish it were, but I don't think anyone would claim that. You know,
maybe.
No, they'd say because of the teaching responsibilities and a lot of other things that...
Maybe. That may well be.
Striving to become so.
But nonetheless, I don't believe that can explain...
I think that
if you look at the figures on administrative costs
mm-hmm.
alone, unfortunately, in the study I made, I was hard put to it to get decent figures on administrative costs. You're much more of an expert in this area than I am, and I'm sure you could get them. And I would love to see a breakdown of total costs, medical costs, between administrative costs and actual medical costs. Well, I know that the fraction of total costs going to physicians has been going down, not up.
Well, physician gross incomes are about 20% of the grand total of healthcare costs. That's been roughly steady, but
of course... They were 25% before mm-hmm. World War II.
Oh, okay. I meant, you know, since 1960 or something, it's been fairly...
You're a young man, you see. You don't go back as far.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's hard to sort out on this business of administrative costs. Part of it gets back to, you know, one important source of administrative costs are dealing with individuals and small groups in health insurance markets. That's why I'm looking for, you know,
but
risk,
look, tell me what government-run program is this?
I didn't say government.
Tell me what government-run program. No, no, I'm saying something different.
Okay.
What government-run program is efficient?
Well, you know, I'll have to tell you when you're asking me that. Recall, Milton, that I spent the 1960s as point man for Robert McNamara trying to bring cost effectiveness to the Defense Department.
I know that
and,
very
you know,
well.
People, when I say that now, they kind of laugh, you know, what a quixotic task. And I say the main thing that I learned then was that the ideal weapon system is built in 435 congressional districts and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly came away convinced there were systematic reasons why one cannot expect the Defense Department to be efficient. There are 435 congressmen who don't care whether the weapon works, they just want it built in their district with jobs protected and so forth.
And it's not very different in healthcare. And so ultimately, I think we both agree, yeah. I think, that the direction we ought to move in is greater individual responsibility.
Much greater, right.
We ought to move in the direction of more privatization, if I may call
right.
it, of healthcare.
Yes.
And in particular, we ought to move in the direction of making it possible for individuals rather than their employers.
Yeah. Right.
Now, I'm, I suppose, more radical and optimistic about how far you could conceivably go in that direction and about how much good it would do than you are, because you've been more deeply involved in trying to do something.
You get worn down after a while. Well, it's that, and it's partly looking for efficient mechanisms for dealing with the administrative costs, achieving economies of scale, you know, getting the information codified and communicated in such a way that people can understand it and act on it without, you know, having to first become a PhD in medical economics.
Now, if to close our up, we move away from the question of what we would like to see happen, we might take just a minute for me to ask you a question. What do you think will in fact happen?
Well, first, we've got this monster, you know, $820 billion of spending now, growing 11% per year. So I think that something serious is going to have to be done pretty soon. Although whenever I say that, I think of my great professor Paul Samuelson, who was asked once, do you think there's going to be a recession next year? And he said, yes, I do, but of course you have to remember that I predicted 11 out of the last 5 recessions.
Yes,
so I think
know.
Of that modestly, and I think I have predicted 20 out of the last 0 healthcare crises. But I think we'd agree that this has just gotten way too expensive.
It's
something has to be done.
My feeling is that we're on a fast track toward complete socialized medicine.
So now I think we are at we're coming to a kind of a fork in the road. One point of view is we ought to make a serious effort to make market mechanisms work, and they include the kind of things you're talking
right.
about, informed, responsible individual choice, that people have to understand this costs money. If they want something that costs more than something else, they have to pay for it and so forth, versus the alternative, which has a strong contingent in Congress, wants to impose federal price controls on doctors and hospitals and drugs and everything else. And I think we would both be pretty horrified by that prospect. Sometimes,
but I think the second, the other track, or the second track, includes government assuming complete responsibility for payment of medical care.
Right.
What's called the Canadian or the British system.
Yeah.
Which are, as I see it in the American context, I think it's operating badly there. And in Britain in particular, you're getting a growing contingent of private medicine side by side. In Canada, they have the safety valve of coming to the United States.
Right.
It's interesting, British Columbia, you talked about bypass operations. They had such a long waiting list that they made a contract with a hospital in Seattle.
Sure.
To do, I think, something like 200 bypasses at an average cost which was considerably less than their own average cost under
the socialized system. Sure. Well, that was smart buying, of course.
Very
that was
smart
buying.
Move. But what I'm saying is, if you move in that direction, the ultimate result will be health rationing and long waiting lists.
Well, the interesting thing is in Britain, of course, a couple of years ago, the Conservative government made a major move in the direction of restructuring into something called the internal market, and to restore market mechanisms, and to say that whereas previously each district health authority was the monopoly supplier for all services, now the district health authority becomes the purchaser on behalf of people in its district, but the services that they buy are supplied competitively. So they have, you know, done the thing that brought all the trouble, as you predicted. That is, by completely socializing it, they destroyed any incentive for people to use the services economically or for people to improve the efficiency with which the services are provided. The efficiency got worse and worse and worse. The waiting times got longer and longer. And so they have moved back toward market mechanisms. And it's very interesting to watch. The first returns are quite promising, that when hospitals realize they're in competition, they start innovating in ways that bring down the cost.
Well, I hope we don't have to go through that costly process, that we can learn from their experience.
I sure hope so.
But I'm very pessimistic in this area.